Good morning. So we'll pick up from last time and adjust the mic volume to the magic place where it doesn't make horrible noises, but it actually does some, which probably isn't there. There? Maybe? Probably. Okay, so last time we went over logistics. We mentioned we're going to have homeworks and quizzes. Quizzes will use the same system as 3130. I will briefly show that. I think most people here are okay at 3130 with me, but, and we'll start this, when we release this evening, due before the next lecture, probably with about 3 questions. I'm pretty short, but I'm going to try to have a regular cadence, and it will be this evening, so I have time to make sure I don't have things on the quiz that aren't in the lecture and that my TAs hopefully look over it. We went over a bunch of terms that we'll end up just casually using throughout the semester. We have hosts and nodes. Instead of host was our kind of our endpoints of our network. Host nodes were sort of anything that participated in a network. We had switches that were responsible for moving data within a network, and routers that were responsible for moving data between networks. And at this point, we don't have like a very firm distinction between what's the difference between two different networks being connected versus one network that has two pieces. We'll have some ways that we can maybe define that more precisely, but often in practice, it's kind of a fuzzy line. Talked about links. We talked about this kind of notion of flows, that we're talking about moving data in our networks, and we usually have lots of data that's not sent all at the same time. And we want to say it's one sort of set of data, and the term we use for that set of data is a flow. And what exactly that will mean will depend on what we're dealing with. If we're dealing with the router, we kind of care about, you know, things that separate the sets of data the router needs to handle differently, versus if we're caring about like an operating system on a host, we care about considering kind of each socket probably will want to treat separately. Even if the data for two or three different sockets is going to roughly the same place. We talked about interfaces for networks, and we mentioned this stream abstraction. So what you've seen, if you vaguely remember the sockets chat lab from CS01, this idea that we connect to something and send a stream of bytes and send it back, that's what we'll be focusing on. But I mentioned that's not the only interface networks provide. I'm not planning on it, but we could talk about implementing a whole bunch of different interfaces that are also useful. I would say probably if you go into industry, the one you're most likely to see is remote procedure calls. So like, for example, 8 years ago when I interned at Google, like everything internally used remote procedure calls. No one made socket calls, used sockets. And that's probably still the case. But we'll be focusing on that stream abstraction and sort of the steps to implement that. And many of the things that are used to implement that stream abstraction apply to most of the other abstractions. And so we're not like missing a lot by doing that. And we talked about kind of our layered design, which I think you've seen before this course probably, but the idea that we're not going to implement this stream all at once. We don't have a single piece of software that implements the stream. Instead, we have pieces that implement parts of that functionality and sort of call this other piece. And one thing this let us do is that when we have these different sort of abstractions, but they have common functionality, we can hopefully implement that common functionality once. And on the internet, the big piece of common functionality is sending data to the right network, which is what the IP internet protocol layer implements. It also lets us easily sort of change out the physical layer. Like we have networks that work over Wi-Fi and over wired Ethernet, and those work very differently. But that's okay because we can have different implementations of the layers that handle that part of the network. And at the end of lecture, we'll finish up today, we started to look at sort of examples of what goes on in networks. And I mentioned that we have packet capture tools and packet trace analysis tools. So the packet capture tool just gets all the things sent on the network. And we have get a packet trace from that. And we looked at, well, there are these tools, and Wireshark's probably the most prominent. It's not the only one for looking at that, and that can decode what's going on. And we're going to look at examples of that when we talk about specific protocols later in the semester. Also, it's useful to know about if you want to debug things with real networks. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so there's one piece of anonymous feedback. I didn't have the logistics slide posted. If you see something, a dead link on the website, it's not intentional. Let me know, please. And also typos, yeah, appreciate that. And let's skip ahead to where we were looking at last time. So last time we were looking at this example of we're looking at a packet in our Wireshark here that is doing DNS over HTTPS, and we can see we have kind of the components of all the layers, and because one was calling the other, we have this kind of big stack. And typically the way that works is we have stuff for the lower layer, followed by stuff for the next layer, followed by stuff for the next layer, and so on. There's some exceptions to that. So in this case, we had encryption. We can't really do things that way for encryption because the encryption needs to change the data. So we had some of the encrypted data was divided between the different protocols. So in this example, we have HTTP in the encrypted data, and in the HTTP we have this DNS, which we'll talk about what these protocols are much later in the semester, and its data is only part of that encrypted data because it's embedded in HTTP. So we have kind of HTTP header, the DNS stuff. And I was just looking so far, we're looking at this kind of one single packet, but you'll notice that I have like a whole lot of packets up here, and probably some of them are related. And one thing tools like Wireshark let you do is filter them out, and Wireshark has this notion of a conversation filter, that it uses the term conversation to say that that's some sort of sending back and forth for related packets, and here I'm going to select to filter based on things that are part of the same TCP conversation. And what that does is that's going to apply a filter. So you see this box up here lets us specify a filter to limit what packets we see. And when I do that, it gives an expression which just matches some fields in the packets. And the fields are an address, source and destination address, and port number. So the address represents a machine, the port number represents basically a program. So we're having communications between two specific programs, assuming that these addresses and port numbers aren't reused. It's not checking if they're reused. It's not that smart, it's just checking the numbers. And in this example, we have 499 packets in the conversation. And I showed you earlier that the packet we looked at was DNS over HTTPS. You might say, wait a moment. Something's weird here. It doesn't look like we filtered out much at all. We have. There's some packets that weren't part of this. But we have all these protocol fields here, and they're all these different protocols. What's going on there? Right? Isn't this all part of the same thing? Shouldn't this all be the same protocol? And this is all, in my example, I know that this is DNS over HTTPS. That's the only thing this app connection's actually used for. But not every packet is specific to that protocol. And Wireshark is just looking at the packet and saying, what's the highest layer that's used in this packet? And there's a lot of bookkeeping that goes on in those lower layers. And so there's a lot of packets that don't concern the higher layers. And when they don't concern the higher layers, there's nothing for the higher layers to deal with in them. Wireshark doesn't say it uses the higher layer, even though, you know, it's needed to make that work, but it's bookkeeping that doesn't have any DNS, which is our highest layer here, data in it. And sometimes other layers. And also, you'll notice that, you know, we have bookkeeping sent in both directions. So this is a bi-directional communication. And typically, like, pretty much everything we're going to do is going to be bi-directional, even things that conceptually we only actually care about one direction. We'll talk about why. We talk about reliability. So that's my look at packet trace. And then we'll go back to much more conceptual stuff. But before I do that, questions in here. Yeah?
Are these slides on the site? Because I see like a few separate slides.
Are these slides on the site? These are part of the intro slides.
Okay.
And also in the schedule for outline for last, Tuesday, there is a link to the actual file I'm analyzing if you want to just open it up. And, so one more thing I like to talk about from a high-level point of view is the idea of the end-to-end argument. So there's kind of different philosophies about how you build networks. And one thing that a lot of the internet protocols are based on is this end-to-end argument idea. That a lot of functions we need to involve the ends. That to implement the function completely and correctly, we need to have the application at either end to be involved in this decision or else it won't work. And when that's the case, the notion is, well, it's not actually the communication system's job to do that. Because it has to be implemented by the applications at the end. And it can't be a feature of the communication system. That the communication system just can't provide some functionality. Now, that doesn't mean the communication should sit there and do nothing. Because you know, it's going to be a big performance enhancement if it helps out. But we're not going to have the communication system do all the job. And in the internet, kind of this philosophy has led us to have kind of the middle of the network be kind of dumb, usually. That there's this choice of whether I want to have the middle of the network do lots of stuff to help me out or do very little. And this argument has led people to often say, well, you know, it's not going to be enough if the middle of the network does this fancy thing, so why are we bothering to spend lots of effort on implementing that, you know, when it's, you know, only going to be an optimization? It's not going to really solve the problem. And in this original paper by Slotzer, Reed, and Clark, they give the example of reliable data transfer as a problem that the network could not solve for you. And the reason is that we want to protect against a whole bunch of things and to make sure that when we send a file from machine A to machine B, that the correct file is received. And there are just some things that we're not going to deal with in the communication network. So the communication network could be great at detecting if bits are flipped somewhere in the middle, like we're forwarding it, we're doing that store and forward idea, and something is wrong with the switch's buffer and it flips a bit in there. Yeah, the communication system can have ways of protecting against that, maybe. And it can also, as we'll discuss later today, detect against, you know, bits being flipped, you know, as they go over a wire or over the radio, there's some interference or something. But there are some things the communication system can't help with, so if you want intimately reliable data transfer, you're going to implement checks anyways. That there's no avoiding that you're going to need to implement some checks to handle, to make sure the reliable data transfer actually happens, no matter how good the network is. If the network is 100% reliable from it, when it goes out of your computer and into the other, you still need to figure out, what do I do if I'm sending data and crash in the middle? How do I make sure I don't get half a file and don't know? You still need to do things like that. And the author's experience that they talk about in the paper is that they were debugging this problem on their network for a long time, and they had a router with bad memory and a processor. And that was extremely difficult for them to figure out that that was the cause of their reliable transmission not working, because they weren't following this end-to-end idea. They were assuming, you know, the network is going to provide this reliable service, and, you know, then they need to check everything separately, and that really didn't work. And so what the end-to-end principle proposes is that we should prefer having end-to-end checks. So for reliable transfer, we want to like compare the final files and say, did it actually get there? We don't want to care what the middle systems do as far as, are we accomplishing our goal? Now, yes, it would be really great if the network usually sent our file correctly the first time and we didn't have to like try again or compensate for it. But that's going to be kind of an optimization. And the network's going to provide an incomplete version of that, right? It's going to solve part of the problem of getting the data there reliably, or there's other problems we might think about, like getting the data there with a certain speed and so on. But it's not going to be the whole solution. Yeah?
By the communication system, that's like a wire, right?
So a question by communication system, does that mean like the wire? I mean the whole thing we call the network. So all the nodes that are in between our two hosts that are talking to each other. So all the switches and the routers and all the links and wires. Wires or other physical links like radios and so on. You know, that's the communication system. And part of why, so part of the justification behind the end-to-end philosophy is not only do we need to do stuff at the ends to handle sort of things that we, you know, can't handle elsewhere, there's also a lot more pieces that can go wrong in a typical real network scenario. And this kind of the author's experience, that they had this one router with bad memory and processor, and that was like one of like, you know, seven pieces of networking equipment that could be causing this problem. You know, that's a lot more work to get working correctly than if you can fix the problem by having the software in either end deal with it, which is what we do today for reliable file transfer. Right? It's not that we think we should have routers that have bad memory and processors. It's that, you know, that's not a practical thing for us to deal with as far as a network design of depending on the all the routers in the middle, you know, working fully correctly all the time in order to implement our functionality. So there's kind of two reasons why we want to do it, the functionality on the ends. So one is that, you know, it just doesn't handle all the corner cases, but the other is that it's just logistically simpler for us as far as getting correctness. So, questions about this end-to-end argument? And so, in practice, like, we tend to have systems that seem to follow this same design philosophy, and on the internet, you're kind of forced to do that because that narrow waist of IP doesn't really guarantee you much. And that's kind of consistent with this philosophy, that they said, well, you know, we could try to guarantee we'll send things reliably, or we'll send things with a certain amount of time, or things like that, but, you know, that's not always going to work. So what IP typically does is what we might call best effort, that we'll try to do a good job. But we're not going to make real guarantees, because you need to handle what if those real guarantees aren't there at the ends anyway. And if you have things you need to happen, you should be doing the most of the work at the ends to make that happen. And this is the philosophy. You can find a lot of examples of this philosophy being violated in things deployed on the actual internet that you are using. You know, it's not uncommon for ISPs to say, we're going to put something in the middle here that's going to implement this extra feature, even though the end hosts don't want it. There's lots of cases where people actually don't follow this philosophy, but this is kind of why a lot of our internet protocols look the way they do. And we'll see this when we talk especially about reliable transmission, that, you know, that type of functionality and a lot of other internet protocols are implemented in a way where we rigorously avoid getting help from the middle, because that wouldn't be good enough anyways. And because it makes it a lot simpler to deploy the network. So questions about end-to-end principle? While I pull up my brief quiz demo. Okay, so just to talk about the quiz. The quiz is linked off the Colab site. And so this is the quiz page. There's a quiz for week one you'll need to take. It's going to open possibly before 9 p.m., but I have that as enough time for me to teach the other class I need to teach today and get it revised if I need to get it revised and do it before the next lecture. The way the quiz system works, which is going to be familiar to you if you've taken 3130 with me, is that you open up a quiz, you can just enter, change things here and enter comments here. And when the box around the question turns green, it is submitted. You can go back and change it anytime up to the deadline. And whatever's there last is what you submitted. Please use comments, especially since this is a smaller class. Please use comments. You probably will not get partial credit if you don't use comments, and I will try to give you partial credit if you do. So please use the comments field on the questions, especially those kind of more conceptual, philosophical ones. So like, I have a question about end-to-end, and I would sure love to give people partial credit, but it's going to be real hard if you don't use the comments field. So questions on quiz? No. Okay. Here. Okay, so I've changed the order I'm doing this lecture in from what I originally planned, which is going to be slightly awkward, but it's because of our homework next week. So next week we have a homework that's on framing, so I'm going to cover that stuff first, and then we'll go back to cover the physical layer stuff. So the framing layer is going to say, if we can send bits on a wire or some other medium, some link, how do we divide it up into messages? So that's the problem we're going to be dealing with first. And then we'll go back to kind of the more basic topic of, wait, how are we actually sending bits? So I'm going to assume I can send bits on the wire, and I want to divide these up into messages in some way that works. So let's say I want to transmit these three messages here. I have 001, 0110, 0010. I can send bits on a wire. So the most straightforward thing is I just write out those messages on my wire as bits. But this problem here is that I've drawn boxes around the messages. There is no box drawing functionality in our wire. We can just send bits. That's not going to work. So we need some way of indicating where the message starts and ends. And there's multiple strategies we could use to do this. So one idea we could use is that we could write the size of the message before each message. So in this example, I'm writing 3 bits that tells me how long the message is before each message. So this is an idea that can work. And how we would process this is we'd read 3 bits, we'd use that size, we'd read that many bits, and so on. So there's some issues with this. So one issue is that we need to deal with gaps between messages. That's probably a solvable problem. Like, I can just transmit a bunch of zero-size messages in between messages. But another problem, as we'll see later, is that this is not very good if we lose our place. If we lose our place, this is horrible. Right. If I miss one of these messages, we're going to find out, you know, if I miss this bit, you know, I'm suddenly have all the other messages are wrong. And that's pretty bad. So we're going to want an alternate strategy. And our alternate strategy is that we're going to mark the beginning and end of messages with some special sequence. And in this example, I'm going to use the sequence 010. In practice, you probably would use something longer, but I'm trying to save space in my slides and use something short. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send 010 in between each message, rather than sending sizes. And I'm going to, I'll just send blank messages, like my idea for sending empty sizes. And I assume we don't actually really send blank messages, so that's not a problem. Questions about this strategy so far? Yeah?
If you do it this way, why would it not interpret the 010 in the last message and as the start of a new message?
It absolutely would. So we're going to have to solve that problem. But this at least solves the problem that if something gets flipped or so on, you know, here, if I flip this 0 to a 1 to a 0 or something misinterprets that, I'm screwed. Here I'm not. So this is going to be a better starting place. But yeah, we have this problem that I can only transmit messages that don't contain 0-1, basically. And that seems like a pretty bad limitation. So how are we going to solve that? And one solution is that I'm going to replace 0-1 with something else. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say basically that 0-1 is the start of something special. And 0-1-0 is start or end message. And 0-1-1 is 0-1. And if I wanted to be more efficient, instead of having it be 0-1, I could have it be like 0-1-1-1 and then 0-1. And that's actually what real protocols that use this kind of scheme do, just because they want to, you know, not send extra bits all the time. And so I'll replace every instance of 0-1 with in the messages with 0-1-1. And that's when I'm sending it. When I'm receiving it, I'm going to replace every instance of 0-1-1 back with 0-1. So questions on this transformation and why it works? Yeah.
If, like, one of like the 0-1, the extra bits that we're sending, can that possibly be like lost? And if so, how would that impact the message?
So the question is, what happens when bits are lost? We will talk about that explicitly later. That is a good question. And yes, something's gonna get messed up and we're gonna have to deal with that. But the problem I solve versus the size strategy is that at least, you know, if we lose one bit, we're going to see that we can eventually recover. With the size strategy, that was not clear. Like, it seems like we could be out of sync pretty much forever. Yeah?
What if you just want to send 0-1-1?
What if I just want to send 0-1-1? So if my message is, so you're saying you want to send the message 0-1-1.
Yeah.
So how do I send that? So I'm going to send the beginning and end.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to replace 01 with 011. So I'm going to send 011. And then I have this 1 here. I'm going to just send that. And then send 01. And this is our message, which is the encoding of 01. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And an idea that might help think about this is that you can kind of think of this kind of like escaping strings in C or Python, that our 01 is kind of like a backslash. And we have a thing after a backslash, which is either our end of message, you know, kind of like backslash n, or our escape for the backslash, you know, so we're kind of like having quote or backslash quote sort of thing. Yeah. It's the same kind of idea, but we have to make it work with bits instead of bytes, because that's what we're assuming we can actually send on the link. Okay, so questions? And something that, you know, maybe we can make this easier is we could have a physical layer that lets us send more than just a bit at a time. And there are some which do that. In fact, that's actually pretty common. So there's kind of two ways this can show up. I updated the assignment since I made this slide and forgot to update this slide. But there are some physical layers that allow transmitting a byte at a time. And protocols that do framing on them will use something just like this backslash idea. I just showed you the harder version where we only transmit a bit at a time. And it's the same idea, we just have to apply it in a less intuitive way. The other thing is that some physical layers transmit units that are kind of aren't natural. So as we'll talk about when we talk about physical layers, sometimes maybe the physical layer effectively can transmit one of 5 values. And in that case, something we might decide to do is that we might decide it's really annoying to encode our bits into 0 to 4 or 0 to 4. That's like a really annoying transformation. And we really want to have the start and end symbol. So what we'll do is we'll just use, say, 4 for special stuff, like the start and end symbol, and not use it for the messages. And this is, in fact, a common strategy that's used on sort of faster protocols. So like gigabit Ethernet has some extra symbols in what it actually transmits on the wire. It doesn't transmit 0 or 1, it basically transmits like 0 to 300-ish. And they just use some of the extra numbers that don't divide evenly by 2 to have these start and end and things like that. But we don't always have that luxury, of course, so we want to know about this strategy for using start and end symbols, which our textbook calls bit stuffing. Okay, and I promised I'd talk about how does this work with transmission errors. And there's kind of two types of transmission errors we're going to be concerned about. And we'll see why they might happen when we talk about glare. So one is kind of desynchronization, that we can sort of get out of sync with the other end, and we can sort of add or lose bits and bytes, or whatever symbols. And the other sort of error we have is we can have kind of noise or interference, and we can misinterpret a 0 or 1 as a 1 or a 0. And I'll start by talking about the desynchronization because it's probably because everything we do to deal with desynchronization probably is going to solve the flipping bits problem. Flipping bits is actually easier to deal with than what if we randomly just add an extra bit somewhere. Sorry. And with size-based framing, it's bad, right? If I miss this first 0 here because we got out of sync, all the sizes are wrong, and hopefully we'll eventually get the right size, but there's no real guarantee that this will happen in any reasonable time. With the start end marker idea, we can have important bits be lost or added. So in this example, I'm saying we missed the 1 in the 010, right? That's probably one of our most important bits. And yeah, that's going to cause us to get one message wrong, but we'll recover from that. It causes us actually to get 2 messages wrong, right? So we have message 1, 2, and 3, and in this case, messages 1 and 2 do not get there correctly. Maybe if we were really clever, we could recover message 1 and 2, but probably we're not going to do that. We're just going to not have them. But at least, you know, as time goes on, we'll get message 3 in, assuming there's no more transmission problems, all the future messages. Yeah?
So in the bottom row, if you read out length 3 in the header, why would you not attempt to read 3 zeros in a row before that, like, get into the next
header? So question, in the bottom row, if I read length 3 in the header, so this is the start end marker. Sorry, I'm switching between our 2 ideas.
Okay.
So I was saying, if we were doing the size idea, so here, I probably should have used a different color. This is size, and this is a size. These are all sizes. And here, this is just start end. Right. These don't actually tell us anything about the message. They're just saying this is the start slash end of a message. Does that answer your question? And I'm saying that for synchronization issues, we probably really like this start end idea. Other questions here? There's actually another idea for dealing with resynchronization. Our textbook mentions is which is called clock-based framing. So, if we have mostly fixed-size messages, something we can do is we can say we're going to start a message. Say every, in the case of SoNet, what they do is every 810 bytes, there's going to be the start of a message, and they have some marker there. Well, they just look to see if the message every 810 bytes is valid, and that's how they do the synchronization. That if you get desync, you'll notice I'm getting lots of invalid messages, and you try to look for where is a place where messages start that are 810 bytes apart. And you don't need to have an explicit start end marker, because like if you have like size or other information in the message, you'll notice it's wrong if you get out of sync, basically. Yeah?
That's a solution to desynchronization, right?
That's a solution to desynchronization, right? To let you resynchronize. That you just know, you look for something periodically happening at a fixed interval, and you just have to have a way of getting to that interval. I'm not going to talk about the details of this approach, because this is usually not what we do, but I want you to know it's an option. And flipping bits, I would say, has the same sorts of problems. And I guess I've proposed kind of, so 3 solutions, right? I have our size-based solution that I said doesn't work with desynchronization. I have our start end marker. I have this clock-based idea, which, you know, is a good idea if we have sort of fixed-size messages and have some way of detecting if a message is valid or not, but otherwise seems more complicated. And we kind of have a trade-off here, right? The size-based idea was really attractive because when the sizes are large, we don't have to spend, we code the size, but we don't have to send any extra space like manipulating the message bits. And the start end marker idea, well, we dealt with desynchronization, but we had to like fiddle with the message to hide our end marker in the message. So there's something we can do that's in between where we use a start marker to say where messages start so we can resynchronize, but we also use sizes to say how long the messages are, and we don't escape things in messages. We just look to see when do we start getting valid sizes after a message. And if we see start markers that don't have, where the size doesn't get us to another start marker, we know we're not synchronized yet. Let's try again. Yeah?
Just confirming, so for the fixed size frame technique, it only helps to recover from desynchronization when we use the start and end marker idea, right?
Question, the fixed size frame technique only helps to recover from desynchronization when we use the start end marker. When we use that or some other thing to help out. Yeah. Alone, it's pretty bad for recovering from desynchronization. We need to do some extra work that is not obvious. And I think typically what you'll see happen is that they just will use the start end marker idea to deal with desynchronization.
And would that technique help recover from pure size based framing?
Would that help recover from pure size based framing?
Yes.
So you basically, I'm proposing you can combine it with size based framing. So what we could say is that I don't want to escape things in my messages, right? Because that was our problem with our start end marker. I have these red things here where I have to change the message I'm sending. So an idea you could have is you could send a start marker and a size and then sort of unescape data. And this might have a spurious start marker in it, but the idea would be that hopefully you can figure out by looking at either the size or some other data from the message we'll talk about in a bit, that, oh, I'm out of sync, let's look for another start marker. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so I'm not mentioning this as the first strategy to use because it's much more complicated, but it's doable. And you might say, you know, and this seems complicated because I'm proposing right now that we like have to like have this heuristic where we say, oh, I find a start marker and a size, and to skip ahead, look for the, make sure there's a start marker there. You know, that seems like that's a lot of work. It would be a lot easier if I had a fast way of figuring out whether messages were correct or not. And we're going to have a solution to that, which is checksums. So one issue we have is I dealt with recovering eventually from desynchronization, but we still have this problem that if we look at what my network is doing in this case, I'm generating this wrong message. And I'd really prefer not to do that. Following the end-to-end principle, generally we're going to assume that there's something will deal with it if it's not like correct eventually, but we'd really like to avoid generating these wrong messages most of the time. And so our primary approach for that is going to be checksums. That we're going to have some way of checking when we get a message out, something we think is the correct message, that it's probably correct. And even though the end-to-end principle says this needs to be checked at the ends, typically we're going to do this at the framing layer because it's faster to detect this early. So this is a performance optimization. We're not going to say, I'm going to transmit all your messages correctly. We're not going to do that. But we're going to provide a good service, and part of providing a good service, especially over things like Wi-Fi, is going to be trying to find most errors fast. We're not going to find all of them, we're going to find most of them. And the idea of a checksum is that instead of sending the message, we basically send the message and it's hash, some sort of hash of the message. And if we think about my idea of having start markers and checking if it's valid for the size, the checksum lets us check that, right? If we get a message and a checksum and a size and we get those bits and it doesn't match, well, let's look for a next start marker until things start working. So the idea here is that we're going to send this hash, and when we receive, we're going to recompute the hash, see if it matches, and if it doesn't, we're just going to discard the message. We're just going to say it didn't get there. You could imagine maybe we could tell people you have this corrected message. We're probably just going to get rid of it. Just going to say, just act as if nothing happened. And the hashes we use are called checksums. And we're actually going to see this pattern repeated a whole bunch of times. So we're going to have checksums at this lower layer where we're doing framing messages. We're going to have them at all most of the higher layers because everyone cares about their data getting there correctly, and the data could be corrupted in all sorts of places. So there's going to be a whole bunch of places where we have this same checksum idea. And the checksum, since it's a hash, it provides high probability that we discard incorrect messages. It's not 100%, and we know it's not 100%. And how high is that probability? It depends primarily on how large our checksum is. Because from sort of a first approximation, it's a probability problem. What's the chance that the randomly corrected message generates the same number as our message, given that there are, say, 2 to the 32 possible numbers, like it's 1 and 2 to the 32. So questions about sort of the basics of this checksum idea. So this checksum idea gives us a way to quickly check messages. I'll talk about kind of what common checksums are, just so you know. We're not going to be care about implementing them. And for the framing assignment, you need to have a checksum. It happens that the zlib library that comes with Python has the CRC32 function, which is a checksum. There you go. That's one option. But in IPv4 and TCP, there's a checksum which is based on 1's complement addition. So not 2's complement, 1's complement. And why would they choose this checksum? I think the reason they chose it is that it's really fast to implement in software or in hardware. Right, that's what they cared about. Also, it's really convenient from a perspective of checking that you can do the checksum calculation without removing the checksum from field from the message first, the way they set it up in IP and TCP. In Ethernet, the checksum is a 32-bit, what is called a cyclic redundancy code. If you take CS/ECE4434, you'll probably learn exactly how that works. We're not going to really care, but the reason why they did this instead of like a normal hash function or just this add up all the numbers idea is one, that it's possible to implement this really fast in hardware. In software, it's actually a lot more awkward, but in hardware, it's really fast. And it has it's designed mathematically so it can detect up to 3 bits flipped for the size used in Ethernet. So Ethernet supports up to about 1500 byte messages. And the way the checksum's designed, if you flip any 3 bits, the checksum will always change in a 1500 byte message. And that's not going to be true if you just choose a random, if you choose like a truly random hash function, that wouldn't happen. So this is like a deliberate mathematical design. Yeah?
The ones complement, do you check the carry bit after every single addition or after all of the numbers have been added up?
Question, do you check the carry bit after every single addition? I believe after every single one. I would have to look it up to know the details. I would say, in practice, these checksums are someone's implemented a checksum library and you use it. is how it works. But like the key design ideas I want to get across are like the checksum choice, like there's the two big factors are usually, is this really fast to compute? And is this going to detect the errors I care about? And I'm not sure actually the addition detects the errors you care about, since there's certain types of errors it's bad at detecting. Like if you just add a bunch of zeros to a message. Like, it's very bad at detecting that, but that's, like, those are the two big design considerations for checksums. Yeah?
If I remember correctly, I think CRC are, like, redesigned with the idea of, like, taking streaks if the network goes down for a second, like, extra ones or extra zeros, like, they're pretty good at detecting that, like, more than three sometimes.
You're remembering that they can detect, yeah, they're good at detecting streaks, yeah. So I'm giving you, like, the guaranteed properties here. And the guaranteed is like worse than what happens for random errors, right? This is like, if you're maliciously flipping bits, it will still detect it. And so if you're randomly flipping bits, it's likely to detect, you know, almost all errors that would happen. Not all of them. And why am I saying not all of them? Well, you know, if I have, you know, a data center with, you know, 10 gigabit Ethernet, and I have 1,000 wires carrying 10 gigabit Ethernet, which wouldn't be uncommon, And I think of how many byte messages are sent over a day, even if my error rate is like 1 in a trillion, it's gonna happen. Like, it's not gonna be 0. Okay, so other questions about checksums? Okay, so checksums are the way we detect errors, and this gives us extra options in framing, because now we can at least say, oh, this start marker wasn't right, or something wasn't right with this message. Maybe the start marker wasn't right, maybe the message was wrong. But let us detect errors. And there's a more advanced technique that we're not going to go into the details of, but I want you to know exists, of error correcting codes. So with checksums, we're adding extra bits to a message to figure out something is wrong with the message. We don't know what. Maybe the message wasn't actually at that location. Maybe some bit in the message got changed. Maybe some bit in the checksum got changed. But we don't know what's wrong, but at least we know enough not to keep going with this message that's broken. But if we're sending extra bits, something we can do is we can try to fix errors, presuming the errors aren't too bad. So for example, we could come up with a way where we could handle, what if, you know, we know at most like 20 bits are flipped. Can we send like an extra, you know, several bytes and fix those 20 bits that are flipped? And there are systems designed to do this called error correcting codes. And they are in fact used in some networks, typically not in things like Ethernet, because Ethernet error rates are like, you know, 1 in a billion sort of thing. But they're used commonly for things like Wi-Fi, where the error rates of the actual physical media are a lot higher. And it's, you know, really nice to drop fewer messages by fixing the errors most of the time. Basically, you're sending extra copies of the data in a very clever way, is the intuition. Like, the simplest way would be, when you send a message, send 3 copies of it. But obviously, that's very inefficient, so there's some mathematical tricks that kind of achieve that sort of effect. But instead of sending 3 copies, maybe you send 1.5 copies somehow. But how do you send a half copy? There's clever mathematical tricks that let you do that. Questions about error correcting codes? Okay, so as I mentioned, we're gonna have a homework on framing, which is tentative due right now, next week. And in the homework, you're gonna implement sending and receiving messages, which are gonna be supplied to you as a bunch of bytes using bits. I'm gonna have a call function called sendMessage, giving you a message, which is a bunch of bytes. And this is gonna call sendBits. And an array of bits, like 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. And we're going to call back a handle bit for mass network function, and you're going to have to reconstruct the messages you sent. So the simple part is when there's nothing goes wrong, you just, you know, we call you, you call us back with the same stuff. We also want you to handle errors by discarding messages, by having some sort of checksum when they're corrupted, and eventually recovering from desynchronization issues. So, you know, if we corrupt the first message in a sequence of like 20, we want to get like the last 10 at least, basically. So questions on sort of the assignment? And I guess I will say, this assignment, like several in this class, is new, so there might be bugs in it, I'm hoping not. I'm hoping I can get my TAs to help me audit the assignment, but please let me know. Yeah?
When you said you changed this, did you update the skeleton code
then? Did I update the skeleton? Yes. An earlier version of the assignment had you, it should be updated, the earlier version of the assignment had you send the messages using bytes instead of bits, and I decided if we're going to talk about bit stuffing, you should implement bit stuffing rather than something else. Other questions? Yeah?
Wait, so is send message working on bytes or bits?
It's working on bytes. So your message, it's in Python, we're going to call send message on something like literally a byte string.
Okay.
So if you know, so I don't know whether people know bytes in Python that well, but if you put a B before a string, it makes it a string of bytes. But that's what we're passing to your function. And the skeleton code should send messages by adding a \0, a null character to the end, and just sending that and looking for that when decoding, which doesn't handle a whole bunch, which doesn't handle both errors and also doesn't handle messages that contain 0 bytes. \0 is already, which you need to handle. Other questions? Okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning, I covered this stuff first because it's on the assignment, but we kind of glossed over, we can send bits on our medium. How does that actually work? So we're going to talk a bit about physical media. I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on it because this is not an ECE class, and if you want to really learn how physical media works, hopefully that's covered in the ECE signals and systems class, which I understand a few people here may have taken. But we want to have some context on that. So there's lots of different types of physical media. So I have some pictures here. I have a picture of the least efficient fiber on the market that's commonly used for audio. So here we can see that it's transmitting visible light, which is how this audio fiber works. But for fiber that's used for computer networking, usually it won't be visible light. It usually will be infrared, but it's the same idea. We have this strand that can carry a light signal back and forth. I have Ethernet here, which is actually a bunch of pairs of wires go together. And we can send signals on these wires. And sort of the most obvious way is going to be by varying the voltage on them. There's some other ways too. I have here, this is a so-called free-range optical transmitter receiver. I probably use this infrared, so it's kind of like your TV remote, but this is a gigabit version, not a speed of your TV remote version, and two directions. Have here, a cutaway of a cable, as in cable modem. Here we have one wire, but it transmits a very complicated signal. It has some very necessary shielding, which I don't understand because I'm not an electrical engineer. And we have our classic sort of Wi-Fi radio transmitter. And there are a whole bunch of other mediums we can imagine using. But like, there's a bunch of common ways, where we can have something that can carry messages. So we have messages carried through light, through varying voltages on one of several wires, or varying other electrical characteristics, through a varying light of different source. We don't have to go through a cable, and varying sort of radio signals and other varying signals. But our basic idea, right, I have labels for this, is that we can vary some notion of what we're transmitting. So like voltage, intensity, amplitude, whatever term we want to use, or frequencies. And we have a signal that goes from low to high in some manner. And kind of the simplest way, which we'll start out with, is let's just assume we're going to only transmit bits. So we're going to transmit low or high. So we've chosen something to vary. Voltage and radio intensity and so on, whatever we've chosen, we'll vary it over time and we'll transmit bits. So here, I'm transmitting bits, zeros and ones. But there's a problem here. What am I transmitting? What's this message of bits I'm transmitting? Yeah. Okay, so your question is like, how many zeros is this? How many ones is the thing? Yeah, we don't know. We need to have some notion of how fast are we sending things. And, you know, this message is ambiguous. Is that where our zero, is that, are we sending that signal, 0100100? And you might say, well, we aren't, because this is like out of sync, right? But it's going to be out of sync in practice, right? It's not going to be precise. It's going to be close. And if you look at this signal carefully, right, it's not perfect, right? There's no like equal divisor that makes sense. And that's going to be typically the case in the real world, right? Because our hardware isn't going to be perfect. Yeah, it's not going to be, you know, nanosecond accurate all the time. So we have to like have an idea. So it could be this, maybe it could be this. Oh, right, could be twice as fast. Maybe it could be something in between. You know, this one looks less plausible because it's even more out of sync, like a little out of sync, but are we really sure? So we have to have some notion of when are we sending each bit. And one way of doing this would be to send a clock signal. So we could send a separate signal just to tell us when we're sending things in the other signal. So I could send a signal here, you know, or I can kind of try to reconstruct this. So we have some clock, and that tells us when messages are. And if we're receiving signals like this, you know, I can observe that, oh, well, if I see this probably means my clock is out of sync with the signal. And, well, that wouldn't happen if we actually followed the approach of sending a clock signal and the real signal together, right? They would probably stay in sync because they're generated from the same place. But we don't want to actually send a separate clock signal. We generally, that's not going to be efficient. So typically, we're going to use some solution which is so-called self-clocking. And what we can do is we can say, well, when I see this here, I can say my clock is a little bit slow. So let's fix that. And I can kind of tweak my clock to match the transitions in the signal I'm getting. And this is a common idea that's used for dealing with the clocking, is that we just look for these transitions and we use that to make sure we stay in sync with our receiver. And most of the time this works and we don't lose or add bits. If it doesn't work, that's why I said losing or adding bits would happen. Because we have these cases where we missed one of these, things got out of whack enough, and oops, lost a bit. So this idea, you know, for synchronizing is really nice, but it doesn't work if our message doesn't have these transitions. That for us to have these kind of resets, if I was just sending all zeros or all ones, we wouldn't know that. And there's also a secondary problem that I'm kind of showing the low and high point as being fixed, but just like kind of our clock signal can drift back and forth, that low and high point can drift up and down. So we also need to synchronize that in kind of the same manner. We need to figure out what is the low point that this that is being sent to me and the high point of intensity that's being sent to me, or whatever we're varying. So one idea that you could do for this, and something that Ethernet actually does, at least old Ethernet, 10 megabit Ethernet, is that their start message thing is a whole bunch of 01, 01, 01, 01, 01, 01, 01 has in every start message to help with the synchronization. And for sure, for this, you know, works for very short messages, but it's not such a great thing for big messages, or if you don't want to send lots of extra non-message bytes, right? To do this, this works, but we're sending a whole bunch of stuff that isn't useful. So an idea that our textbook mentions, that is actually what's done in 10 megabit Ethernet for the body of the message to make sure things stay in sync, is this idea called Manchester encoding, that this is our raw message here, and what we do in Manchester encoding is we XOR it with the clock signal when we're generating the message. And the point of this is that we guarantee that there's one transition for every bit. And that means that we can resync our clock, we have at least once every bit, possibly in the middle, possibly at the end, depending on whether it's a 0 or 1. And so this is sort of one idea of dealing with that. This ensures that we only have one signal this time. We don't have to send a separate clock signal, but we also ensure that we can use this self-synchronizing idea to figure out how fast are we sending bits and not get too out of sync. So questions on this Manchester coding idea? Yeah. What does the last signal represent? So another strategy is that we can represent a message by, we can represent, so a strategy that's kind of, you know, not as extreme as Manchester encoding is that we can represent a message with transitions for when we're going from zeros to ones and vice versa, when we're changing the polarity of our bits, is I believe what it is. We aren't going to actually go over the NRZI encoding, so I don't have it memorized, I'm sorry. But this is another, yet another encoding option that tries to have transitions at a certain sort of pace. That's besides Manchester. So Manchester isn't the only game in town, but it's, I think, the simplest to understand, and this is about the level we're going to go at. And it is actually what 10 megabit Ethernet used. Now, bigger Ethernet, faster Ethernet uses something different, but probably the primary reason for that is that they probably transmit not just 0-1, they transmit sort of more fidelity. So you want to have a different scheme. Now, Manchester encoding, so this solves our synchronization problem, but it's actually pretty wasteful. And if we're thinking of how much stuff can we send over a wire, a key constraint is we can only have transitions from low to high and vice versa so often. And here, we're kind of using our budget of transitions, like we're using two of them, paying for the cost of two transitions per bit. The space that could fit two transitions from low to high. And so this is not so great, but it works. So it's not so great in the sense that it doesn't make good use of the capacity of the wire or other medium. So there are kind of more clever compromises which have the same idea. Like the key idea of Manchester encoding is that we want to make sure no matter what we're sending, we're going from 0 to 1 and 1 to 0 a lot of times. So there's other encodings that do this, but waste less space. They do it with fewer transitions to send the same amount of bits. One example you can look up is 4B, 5B encoding, which basically, you know, encodes 4 bits using 5 bits that's guaranteed to have lots of transitions, or enough transitions. But it's the same kind of idea. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So when you showed the diagrams of the transmissions, there was a clear distinction between the 0 and the 1, the low and the high.
Yeah.
Is it possible for there to be like either fluctuation due to interference or something like that where the data is kind of in the middle? And if so, how would you figure out if it's a 0 or a 1?
So the question is there, when we transmit stuff, is it not going to be clearly 0 or 1? It's going to be somewhere in the middle? Absolutely. So in that case, sometimes we'll have corrupted bits. Or in the case of the self-synchronization, if it's too bad, we'll see transitions where there's not supposed to be one, and we'll have errors, and hopefully the signal will come through clearly later so we can recover from that. but that in indeed is a thing which will happen. And this notion of like how clear the signals are, like this might be true, like, you know, on a nice short Ethernet cable with everything going right, but it's not going to be so true in less optimal scenarios, right? The signal is going to be noisier, and we're going to be kind of having the hardware, you know, kind of near, closer to the edge of what its sensitivity. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So, another thing we can do with transmitting messages is that we don't just have to vary sort of this one signal thing. So here I've been saying we have a low and a high. I'm thinking like an Ethernet is like low voltage, high voltage, 10 megabit Ethernet, I should say. And in simple radio transmission, maybe it's sort of high amplitude, strong radio signal, weak radio signal is what we're doing. Or maybe high frequency, low frequency signal being sent on a carrier. But there's other things we can vary, even in kind of one signal. So one example that's simple to understand is that if we're sending things like this, we can actually vary the length of this kind of separately and measure that to send our signal, for example. And we can also, we can like try to use in-between points to send our signal if we have things sensitive enough. And different schemes really do all of these, and sometimes do multiple of them at once. So we'll vary multiple attributes of the thing we're sending over the signal at the same time and measure them. And I'm not going to cover that in like a whole bunch of detail, because that's more of an ECE topic, but the ECE signals course should cover that sort of stuff. Like, probably the big thing you need to understand to do that is that they deal a lot with phase. So like if you have a thing like this versus something that's shifted over, like that's very useful electrically. And I don't have the intuition, and I don't know how to teach the intuition for that, and it's not going to matter for us for as much, but I want you to know, like, that's kind of the basis of the sort of better physical layers, is that they can make more clever use of looking at all the attributes of that signal they're sending to, like, shove more data in there more efficiently and more reliably. And I think my next topic is going to be about reliability. So I'm at a transition point and probably shouldn't start it. And I think we've seen this in, so I'll do our brief preview. Is that our next topic is we're going to talk about, go back up the stack to reliability. So we dealt with one form of reliability, which is not corrupting messages. But the way we dealt with that is we said that when the message gets corrupted, it just disappears. So what we want to do is deal with retransmitting it, and we learn, if you took CSO2 here, you learn that kind of our basic strategy is that we're gonna have a timeout and we're gonna retransmit it. And we'll talk more about that as kind of our main topic for next week, including sort of how to make this efficient, which is not something we did in CSO2.